Thank you very much, Martin. It's great to be here. So it's a real privilege to be the first speaker in this series. As mentioned, I've recently published a book on the International Drug Control System, and my paper today draws largely on the ideas within that book, which of course is in all good bookshops now, just in time for Christmas. But also I hope to develop a few ideas beyond that. I'm conscious that we are recording today for a podcast, so rather than just have a series of slides with general conversation around the slides, as I normally do, I have actually prepared a formal paper. I'm hoping, though, that it won't last too long, and then we'll have plenty of time for a Q&A afterwards. So, in March 2009, representatives of more than 130 countries met in Vienna, the home of the UN bodies for dealing with what's become known as the world drug problem. Delegates were tasked with concluding a year-long review of progress achieved by the International Drug Control System against the goals set by the UN General Assembly special session on the world drug problem, what's become known as the UNGAS. At that 1998 session in New York, and under the quixotic banner, "A Drug-Free World, We Can Do It," with an exclamation mark, you mustn't forget the exclamation mark, member states had agreed to a political declaration committing themselves to work towards eliminating or reducing significantly the illicit production of coca, cannabis and opium, as well as achieving significant and measurable results in the field of drug demand reduction by the then planned review in 2008. After 6 grueling months of interstate negotiation, the meeting was also the venue for the announcement of a new political declaration and accompanying action plan. These soft law instruments, like their predecessors 11 years earlier, would do much to set the direction for international drug control efforts for the next decade or so. During the general debate, a number of states pointed to the obvious fact that the UNGAS goals had not been met and lamented perceived shortcomings within the draft declaration. Yet final approval of documents closely resembling those from the UNGAS signalled an ostensible acceptance of the structures and ethos of the UN multilateral drug control system. While agreeing to an integrated and balanced strategy to counter the world drug problem, all delegations in Vienna consequently provided formal and ongoing backing for a now well-established treaty framework, a framework built upon the doctrine of prohibition. But as dramatic events in the closing minutes of the meeting were to highlight, not all states were equally enthusiastic in their support for prohibition in its punitive form. Today, during its centenary year and barely past the 50th anniversary of the regime in its current form, there remains substantial agreement among states on many aspects of the conventions upon which it's based. Yet diverging views on the non-medical and non-scientific use of a range of controlled substances makes drug policy an increasingly contested and consequently transitionary field of multilateral cooperation. So what I'd like to do this afternoon then is explore and analyse the sources, manifestations and sometimes paradoxical implications of this divergence. As we'll see, in the years between 1998 and 2009, a period for the sake of simplicity I'm going to call the UNGAS decade, the UN drug control system experienced an increase in internal tension and what I will argue was a related and subtle form of transformation. Highlighting the centrality of the harm reduction approach and tolerant cannabis policies to this ongoing process, I'm going to examine the efforts of those actors seeking to defend the existing international control framework and explore rationales and scenarios that may lead states to move beyond it. Recent events in Latin America demonstrate that such a revisionist impulse is no longer hypothetical. And as such, looking backwards to see what we can learn from the UNGAS decade is useful in considering not only its current condition, but also the fascinating, if perilous, challenge of assessing the future of the international drug control system. But to begin with, I need obviously to outline the structures and dynamics of that system. So the contemporary international drug control system, or what has been usefully described as the global drug prohibition regime, is constructed on a suite of UN treaties. These are the 1961 Single Convention on Narcotic Drugs, as amended by the 72 Protocol. Hereafter, a treaty that I'm going to refer to simply as the Single Convention. The 1971 Convention on Psychotropic Substances and the 1988 Convention Against Illicit Trafficking in Narcotic Drugs and Psychotropic Substances. Based upon a series of agreements, as we've heard, dating back to 1912, the treaties were established by the international community with a core objective of preventing the non-scientific and non-medical production, supply and use of narcotic and psychotropic drugs. Legal structures and rules within them are guarded by two principal means of achieving drug control. These are commodity control, the definition and regulation of the illicit production, supply and possession of drugs for medical and scientific purposes, and penal control, the suppression through criminal law of illicit production, supply and consumption of drugs. The conventions then operate with the intention of creating an appropriate balance between penal sanctions, the degree of real and or potential harm associated with specific drugs and their therapeutic usefulness. Consequently, all the treaties contain schedules or lists categorising substances according to their perceived liability to abuse and their risk to public health. Indeed, as affirmed in the preambles of all the instruments, an important guiding principle of the treaty framework is a concern for the health and welfare of humankind. Within this context, the international control system has developed on the basis of two interconnected tenets. These are that the best way to reduce problems caused by the prescribed use of scheduled drugs is to minimise the scale of the illicit market, and that this can be successfully achieved through a reliance on prohibition-oriented supply-side measures. Now, like most UN treaty-based regimes, a number of organisational actors are involved in the functioning and oversight of the three conventions and the associated political declarations and action plans. Now, key among these is the Commission on Narcotic Drugs, the CND, or Commission, which is the central policy-making body for the UN drug control system. The CND, which is made up of 53 UN member states, is assisted in its tasks by the WHO, the World Health Organization, and a body that probably most of you won't have heard of, the International Narcotics Control Board, the INCB, or Board. The Board is, according to its own literature, the independent and quasi-judicial control organ for the implementation of the treaties. It has the authority to assess worldwide scientific and medical requirements for scheduled substances, and importantly, particularly for our discussion, it monitors what it deems to be compliance with the provisions of the conventions. To varying degrees, both the CND and the INCB rely for administrative and technical support upon the United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime, the UNODC, or the Office. Established in its present form in 2002, the Office is the UN agency responsible for coordinating international drug control activities. So just to quickly look at this slide, really what we're interested in here today is the CND, the Commission on Narcotic Drugs. As I said, that's the central policy-making body within the UN system. So that's a functional commission of ECOSOC. That's why it's actually only 53 members, because as a functional commission, it can't be bigger than its parent body, which is 54. So although it's got 53 members, you have lots of other states involved within the process. I mentioned the INCB, which is very important in terms of how it perceives nation states' compliance with the treaties. And as I said, these are assisted in their actions by the Office on Drugs and Crime, and also within this process we have the World Health Organization as well. So it's quite a complex map, but hopefully that provides you with some idea of the bodies that are involved within the international system. So within this treaty framework, regime members, so by that I mean states who have signed up to the treaties, are afforded a certain degree of discretion, or if we're going to use the technical jargon, wiggle room, in the formulation of national drug control policies. Now this is derived from a combination of factors, including the textual ambiguity of the instruments and subsequent subjective legal interpretation. Yet, and this is hugely important, flexibility is limited. So while there has long been variation in national policies between parties to the conventions, a spectrum incorporating policies ranging from quasi-legal coffee shops in the Netherlands to zero-tolerance policing of drug users in many parts of the world, the existence of the regime does a great deal to restrict freedom of action at the national level. It would, for instance, be impossible for a party, so a state that's signed the treaties, to create a regulated market for the recreational use of cannabis and remain within the accepted boundaries of the current treaty framework. Moreover, the conventions, particularly the single convention, do much to generate a powerful background prohibitionist expectancy or framework of appropriateness, whereby it's felt that all nations should adopt a fundamentally prohibitionist stance to drug use. Now, although ultimately the result of multilateral cooperation and agreement, the shape and operation of the current treaty system is very much a result of US endeavour. The prohibitionist expectancy or norm at the heart of the regime owes much to the largely successful internationalisation of its domestic approach to the issue, an approach predicated on the belief that the recreational use of certain psychotropic substances is morally wrong. And the impressive near universal levels of regime adherence today cannot be divorced from Washington's ongoing interest in international drug control at the UN. So this is actually, I don't want to get off my main point too much, but this is quite interesting in terms of the United States' relationship with the UN. For many years, the US has distanced itself from the UN and the activities at the multilateral level. You can see this in lots and lots of other issue areas, but the drug control area is an exception here. It's an area where the US has dedicated an awful lot of time and energy into ensuring that the system is maintained and that states adhere to the principles and norms within the treaty system. Now, states obviously perceive that there are benefits to be had from regime membership. Yet a combination of the UN's benevolent image and US suasion, both at the annual sessions of the CND and through unilateral mechanisms such as certification, have long helped to ensure that nations become parties to the conventions and do not deviate too far from their prohibitive ethos thereafter. While variable across time and different states, costs, both in terms of national reputation within the international community and good relations, particularly economic, with Washington, are important considerations. Now, part of this dynamic was outlined in 1975 by some Scandinavian authors, Kettlebrunn, Lindpan and Ingemar Rexed, in their, what I think is a seminal book, The Gentleman's Club, The International Control of Drugs and Alcohol. They observed, as you can see from the quote, when a superpower exhibits a high degree of involvement, there is unlikely to be much resistance or unresponsiveness on the part of countries appealed to for support, unless such support is contrary to national interests. Generally speaking, cooperation with the US in drug control matters does not conflict in any significant way with the interests of other countries and is therefore readily provided. And this idea of national interest is a recurring theme. While the end of the Cold War significantly altered many aspects of the international landscape, the dynamic outlined by Brunn and colleagues remained clearly identifiable in the late 1990s and the first decade of the 21st century. However, the change of terrain and the removal of recognisable geopolitical security concerns in the late 1980s and early 1990s triggered a widespread reconsideration of what actually constituted national interest. In the US, the immediate post-Cold War era saw this manifest itself in a complex debate about the very point and purpose of American internationalism. Elsewhere, among many other more obvious recalculations, the loss of the dominating meta-narrative of one concept war, the war against communism, allowed an increasingly widespread reconsideration of another, the war on drugs. Ironically, although the fight against drugs in many ways filled the adversarial void left by the end of the Cold War, this included revised cost-benefit calculations in many, particularly although not exclusively, European states, where for various reasons the issue of illicit drug use was getting higher on the domestic political agenda. In light of the growth and increasingly complex and multifaceted nature of illicit drug problems within their borders, it became evident to an increasing number of nations that the benefits of an interpretation of the conventions that exploited the flexibility within them outweighed the potential costs of deviating from the regime's normative expectancy. This perspective was supported by an improving understanding of illicit drug markets and the so-called unintended consequences of the dominant control paradigm. In this respect, support for the predominantly zero-tolerance US federal approach to drug problems, and by association punitive prohibition underpinning the international approach to dealing with drug use enshrined within the UN conventions, became increasingly regarded as contrary to the national interest. As pragmatic domestic concerns came to the fore, more and more government authorities were no longer content to view drug policy formulation through a US morally inspired conceptual lens. This shift in focus took place in relation to both a more efficient use of finite law enforcement resources and a public health context with increasing awareness of links between injecting drug use and the spread of HIV/AIDS that coincided with a realignment of the international environment after the collapse of the Berlin Wall. So it was these concerns that became important drivers for the behaviour of some states within CND sessions and generated the growing systemic tensions that were to characterise the UNGAS decade. Increasingly dissatisfied with the punitive approach privileged within the conventions, a significant number of regime members engaged in a process of what we can call soft defection. Rather than quitting the regime, this involves states deviating from the prohibitive norm at its core and, in exploiting the available plasticity within the treaties, remaining within what they consider to be their legal boundaries. Since norms are crucial to the essential character of a regime, such a process, which by its very nature involved normative attrition, can be regarded as a form of regime transformation. Crucially, however, in this case, it involved regime weakening and changes within, rather than a more substantive change of the regime. So I've just put together this very straightforward slide to illustrate really what I'm talking about here. So we're seeing soft defection. So this isn't hard defection. This isn't where states are actively leaving the treaty system. What they're doing is they're exploiting the flexibility inherent within the treaty system, but in so doing, moving away from the prohibitive norm at its heart. So these are policy choices at both the supranational level. So here really I'm talking about the EU in many respects, national and subnational levels. And this, I would argue, leads to normative attrition. Now, this is a phrase that I spent a long time, believe it or not, because it's only just two words, which is a bit pathetic, but a long time trying to get the right phraseology. Now, within international relations and regime theory, there is talk of normative erosion, but I didn't want to use erosion because that seemed like a very passive term, because soft defection is an active process. So I thought attrition was more appropriate because it's an active move away from the norm. So we get this, as I said, a deviation from the regime's authoritative norm. What we then get, I would argue, is regime weakening. But crucially, with regime weakening, we see changes within the regime. This is changes in the normative character of the regime rather than changes of the regime. So this is a distinction that I'll come back to shortly. So a key part of what I would describe as this weakening process then, during the UNGAS decade, took place in relation to the issue of harm reduction that I flagged up earlier. So this is an approach generally accepted to refer to programs and practices that aim primarily to reduce the adverse health and social and economic consequences of the use of legal and illegal psychoactive drugs without necessarily reducing consumption. I'm sure most of you are familiar with the idea of harm reduction. Due to the nature of discussions within the CND, the term here today is going to be used really to refer to four main interventions that relate specifically to injecting drug use. So these specifically are opioid substitution therapy, needle and syringe programs, controlled heroin prescription and drug consumption rooms. And I don't know how clear the key is on this, but this is just a map I put together for my book to give some indication of the range of states around the world involved with these specific harm reduction interventions. So the colours show, they don't actually tell you exactly what's going on in each country, but the colours show you, these colours are where there's one intervention, yellow is where there are two interventions, orange is where there's three interventions, and red is where there are all four interventions that I've mentioned. So this is just to give you some idea, this process of soft defection and how widespread it was around the world. And for a really good update on this, an organisation called Harm Reduction International, who used to be called International Harm Reduction Association, every year they do a publication called The Global State of Harm Reduction, which gives you a far more detailed approach of harm reduction activities on a global scale. So as we can see from this map, there was an increasing level of engagement with harm reduction at the national level, and in terms of policy guidance, also at the EU level, the European Union level. And this produced significant debate, often very heated, within the conference rooms of Vienna. Indeed, while the approach was progressively more popular among a growing number of states, its acceptance of continuing levels of illicit drug use provoked hostile reactions from other regime members, particularly the United States, as well as parts of the drug control apparatus, which favoured a more rigid and prohibitionist interpretation of the conventions. And the increasing tensions within the system were visible during both country and regional statements and in debates around CND resolutions. And in the years following 1998 and the UNGAS, the issue of harm reduction certainly oscillated on and off the Commission's agenda according to its place within national policy debates. Nonetheless, statements from those favouring the approach became bolder, with inclusion of what remained within this part of the UN system a controversial term being used more openly by individual states and, in the latter years of the decade, actually by the EU as a collective group. This was particularly the case in 2005 during a thematic debate on HIV/AIDS. But countering such emboldened behaviour, statements from the US and other prohibitionist-oriented states, including Japan, the Russian Federation, and as an EU member state, somewhat incongruously, Sweden, also became more pronounced. At the 2003 midpoint review of progress towards achieving the UNGAS goals, for instance, the head of the US delegation used her statement to stress, "We must resist calls for lenient drug consumption policies. We know that these policies fail to sustain our important efforts as presented by the International Narcotics Convention," she told delegates. And this was a position often echoed and actually reinforced by the INCB and at times the UNODC through its executive director, a gentleman called Antonio Maria Costa. Acting more as a defender or guardian of the treaties than its mandated role as a watchdog working to resolve emerging tensions within the regime, the board was particularly hostile in its opposition to drug consumption rooms. This was so even though legal advice from the UNODC's predecessor found that this and other interventions could operate comfortably within the regime's legal boundaries. Again, just as an aside, when harm reduction became a clear point of tension within the system, the INCB asked for legal advice from the UNODC or its predecessors, the Secretariat. The report that came back said that most of the harm reduction interventions, and certainly all of the ones I'm talking about here today, were legally permissible within the convention framework. But because that advice didn't fit in with the ideological view of the INCB, it disappeared. And it's a document that floats around the system, but the INCB officially doesn't recognise it as a policy document. It's been ignored. But proponents of harm reduction have embraced that document very much. It was, however, I think debates around CND policy positions relating to HIV/AIDS that revealed the true intensity of disagreement on harm reduction. Although customary practice rather than statute, with the exception of scheduling decisions, the Commission doesn't vote. The resultant lowest common denominator setting ensures that outcomes in the forms of resolutions and declarations are typically bland. The final language, however, does much to disguise the intensity of discussions surrounding the negotiations. Between 1998 and 2009, the CND agreed 6 resolutions related to drug use and HIV/AIDS and consequently involved the issue of harm reduction. Introduced by a range of nations, including Australia, Brazil, and the Netherlands, the original versions often contained the term harm reduction and explicit references to needle exchange and sterilised injection equipment. Opposition from the US and other prohibition-oriented states, though, ensured that such language never appear in the final text. The fear among these states was that, while non-binding, the inclusion of such language and terminology within resolutions would legitimise and encourage the approach. Over the years, the often fraught negotiations involved deadlocks, filibustering, the withdrawal of resolutions, heated side discussions, extended sessions, and on at least one occasion that I know of, tears before home time. On many occasions, judicious use of the phrase reducing the negative health and social consequences of drug abuse, as agreed in the 1998 political declaration, eventually secured agreement. But as the decade wore on, it was becoming increasingly clear that there were deepening cracks within the so-called Vienna consensus. Debates about harm reduction also did much to highlight the increasing tensions that existed between the architecture and the operation of the drug control regime and the UN's position on human rights. This was particularly the case in relation to the board. Its stance became increasingly out of step with that not only of other UN bodies engaged in some way with the issue of drugs, for example UNAIDS and also the UN Development Programme, but also with the basic principles of the UN system more widely. However, that the UNGAS decade only saw one CND resolution dealing with the issue, itself fiercely debated, also revealed that not all states shared the view that human rights had a place in discussions on drug policy. And the fragile facade of consensus within the CND was finally broken at the high-level segment, the HLS, of the Commission's 2009 meeting to conclude the review of progress against the goals set at the UNGAS and to agree the new political declaration. In many ways, echoing its predecessor from 1998, the document reaffirms the regime's prohibitionist goals, with member states noting their determination to, I quote, tackle the world drug problem and actively promote a society free of drug abuse in order to ensure that all people can live in health, dignity and peace with security and prosperity. Yet that not all member states were content with all the aspects of the declaration became clear moments after the chairperson's gavel came down on proceedings. With a delivery that brought the conference room to a standstill, then the German ambassador addressed the floor. He slowly listed 26 predominantly European states that wished to add what's called an interpretive statement to the already agreed declaration. Having failed to secure the inclusion of even a clarifying footnote referring to harm reduction within the document during negotiations, the statement announced, and I'll put the quote here on the slide for you, that the aforementioned states declare that they will interpret the term related support services used in the Political Declaration and Action Plan as including measures which a number of states, international organisations and non-governmental organisations call harm reduction measures. This unusual step, unprecedented within the realm of international drug control, was a very public demonstration that any remaining consensus among regime members on how to approach problematic drug use had been shattered. The introduction of the interpretive statement and what can be called the IS-26, that's the group of nations who signed on to the interpretive statement, was undoubtedly one of the more noteworthy events of the UNGAS decade. It's also significant, I think, for what it revealed about the nature of the international drug control system in 2009. As was to be expected, the statement was not well received by those states favouring the strict prohibitive readings of the conventions, the USA and the increasingly important Russian Federation prominent among them. To this group, it was a further undermining of the essential tenets of the treaty system. Yet it's important to note that despite considerable engagement with a range of harm reduction interventions by regime members, only 26 put their name to the statement. In the case of needle exchange programmes, the group represented only about a third of the number of states pursuing this health-oriented practice. So while perhaps to some extent a result of the frantic negotiating environment, such a vertical disconnect between behaviour at the national level and that at the C&D represented, I would argue, a pragmatic calculation of costs. Although not challenging the normative fabric of the conventions, only 26 states felt the issue important enough upon which to expend political capital. To the many others, the costs, either reputational or in terms of more immediate relations with Washington, of engaging with the process were seen to exceed the benefits. Although the statement helped to clarify and to a certain extent legitimise further the place of harm reduction within the international system, involvement with the IS-26 was not imperative for the continuation or uptake of specific interventions. Moreover, it's likely that a degree of free riding was at play, with some harm reduction oriented states content to just sit back while others moved the issue forward. The consideration of specific national interests is also central to any understanding of the debates during the UNGAS decade on another key area of contention, and that is to do with cannabis, as I suggested or alluded to earlier. So after a period of relative policy stability during the 1990s, the UNGAS decade saw increasing numbers of parties to the conventions apply alternative measures to criminal prosecution for cases concerning drug use and the possession of small quantities of drugs for personal consumption. And again, I just put this map up, and I'm not sure how clear the key is, but again, this just gives you some idea, according to the data that I could rustle up, of the countries involved in a process of regime weakness and moving away from the punitive approach to the possession of cannabis for personal use. So effectively here, although I've used different typologies in terms of cautioning, prohibition with cautioning and diversion, and prohibition with civil penalties, we're really here, what we're talking about is what's commonly known as decriminalisation or depenalisation. So within this context, within a broader environment where nation states are moving towards decriminalisation or depenalisation of cannabis, the issue became a significant point of discussion on a number of occasions within the CND during the UNGAS decade between 1998 and 2009. Yet, mindful of the increasing levels of soft defection among regime members via decriminalisation and depenalisation, and also as a special case, medical marijuana schemes, the nature of debate was in marked contrast to that surrounding harm reduction during the same period. Now, if you look at it in quantitative terms, the number of cannabis-specific resolutions at the Commission was comparable to that relating to drug use and HIV/AIDS. It's about 6 or 7. The increasingly forceful and proactive support displayed for the harm reduction approach by some nations within the C&D, however, was not apparent in regard to the subject of cannabis. On the contrary, rather than proactively encouraging discussion, delegates from soft-defecting states pursuing tolerant policies towards the personal use of cannabis generally found themselves fighting a rearguard action. Interventions within debates and negotiations on the text of resolutions were often reactions to attacks on perceived leniency from prohibition-oriented nations. So rather than seeking actively to legitimise national-level policy choices, the priority for these states was to defend them. In many ways, then, the cannabis issue created a reversal in roles to those witnessed during discussions of harm reduction and HIV/AIDS. Moreover, attacks from certain member states were often closely related to the criticism of soft defection emanating from the UN's drug control apparatus itself. Indeed, while the motivations of the states actively opposing the pursuit of liberal cannabis policies by other regime members varied, both the INCB and the UNODC, particularly its executive director, played an important role in shaping and in some instances steering or even stifling debate on the issue within the C&D. So for example, although the Dutch coffee shop system had long been the focus of the board's disapproval, the UNGAS decade saw it widen the scope of its ire in response to growth in tolerant policies elsewhere. Criticism came in the form of a diligent producer versus lenient consumer state narrative, whereby traditional consumer states deviating from a punitive approach to possession of cannabis for personal use were set against producer states that were portrayed as trying their best, within the spirit and letter of the treaties, to to suppress the illicit trade. Now, admittedly a view with some validity, this gained traction with countries like the US, Sweden and Japan, who opposed the liberalising trend on ideological grounds, as well as North African and Gulf states, some of which were more functional in their outlook and hoped to secure funding for cannabis control efforts. And interestingly, while the CND's consensus functioning in many ways worked against soft-affecting states in relation to resolutions on HIV/AIDS, it worked in favour of regime members favouring tolerant cannabis policies. With all seven of the resolutions on cannabis during the UNGAS decade that were introduced by prohibitionist-oriented nations with the intention of tightening up control, states including Portugal, Spain, Italy, Canada and the Netherlands were successful in effectively flattening out the language and removing mention of criminalisation of cannabis use for non-medical purposes. The goal of several resolutions, this would have significantly expanded the scope of the treaties and arguably gone beyond the requirements of the 1988 Convention, which doesn't specifically oblige parties to criminalise drug use. Now, although the INCB's position on both harm reduction and cannabis revealed an increasingly antagonistic attitude towards interpretation of the treaties that it regarded as, if not illegitimate, then at the very least in conflict with their spirit, it was, I think, the issue of coca that truly exposed the extent of the board's willingness to defend the regime rather than seek to diffuse growing tensions within it. The coca issue also revealed the limitations of soft affection, and that while dissatisfied with some aspects of the conventions, many states remained reluctant to support moves that would go beyond the process of regime weakening that I just described. So in terms of background, what's this issue with coca? Well, in now what's regarded by many analysts as a historical error, the coca leaf is included in Schedule 1 of the Single Convention, along with drugs such as heroin and cocaine. Now this is the case despite the ancient and socially ingrained place of coca chewing and coca tea drinking within many Andean nations. The convention bans coca chewing, but allowed countries a temporary exemption under Article 49 to phase out the practice within 25 years. With the convention coming into force in 1964, the deadline for this was 1989. Now, the ongoing practice of coca chewing not unreasonably led the INCB in the 1990s to examine the issue and suggest that states move to resolve the discrepancy, especially in light of the inconsistencies between articles in the single convention and mention in the then recently agreed 1988 convention on traditional licit uses of drugs. With scientific studies on the health implications of coca chewing effectively disappearing without trace into the UN system in the late 1990s, the board's position began to alter. During the UNGAS decade, it became reluctant to highlight tensions surrounding coca and, according to its mandated role, deal with nations concerned in a spirit of dialogue and cooperation, or encourage the CND and the WHO to move to resolve the matter. Instead, the board became increasingly critical of policy positions on coca in a number of Andean states, stepping up its condemnation of both traditional use and the industrialisation of coca products. Within this context, the INCB consequently expressed particular concern over Bolivia's desire to remove the confusion over the legitimacy of ongoing domestic coca chewing and adjust coca-related provisions within the single convention. For officials in La Paz, amendment of Article 49 to remove references to the transitional period was a serious but necessary step. Unlike other states that were able to reduce various costs associated with regime membership via soft defection, Article 49 of the convention provides no wiggle room where coca chewing is concerned. Bolivia's unprecedented move consequently differed to the action of soft-affecting states in relation to both harm reduction and cannabis, since it would have gone beyond regime weakening and actually represented a change, albeit ostensibly relatively minor, of the regime. So whereas other countries were moving to make changes within the regime, what Bolivia proposed would lead to a change of the regime. Now, Bolivian policies and laws on the coca leaf had been under review since the 2005 election of President Evo Morales, a former coca farmers leader and himself a coca chewer. Morales' interest in the issue, admittedly in many respects for domestic political reasons, raised the profile of the issue after Bolivia's initial statements in 2006 and resulted in the unusual appearance of a head of state at the CND on a number of occasions. From early indications that Bolivia was contemplating such a move, the INCB adopted a combative and oppositional stance within its annual report and through statements by its own president. Despite pressure from the board, bolstered by opposition from the US, which included its inclusion on the list of states to be considered for decertification in 2008, Morales himself used the platform of the high-level segment in 2009 to formally announce that Bolivia would begin the necessary legal steps to end the prohibition of traditional uses of coca. And after many twists and turns, this would lead to the most significant challenge to the UN drug control regime since its inception in 1961. So, conclusions, hurrah. What then can we make of and learn from the UNGAS decade? Well, it was certainly a period of transformation, as I hope I've indicated and demonstrated. But rather than a widespread and anterior challenge to the treaty system, this took on the form of a subtle change within the regime whereby a growing number of parties to the conventions deviated from the prohibitive norm at its core. As with all sovereign states operating within a multilateral environment, the calculus of national interest drove such soft-affecting behaviour. Within the context of this axiom, most states were reluctant to expend political capital and incur the various costs associated with working towards a more substantive change of the regime. The resultant process of regime weakening played out in a number of ways at the Commission. Some states were willing to work for the legitimisation of harm reduction via inclusion of the principle, if not the term, in C&D resolutions, and ultimately fight for the addition of the phrase itself to the official record through the interpretive statement at the high-level segment. Conversely, some of those states kept a low profile in relation to domestic cannabis policies, but fought to ensure that any policy space that had been created was defended against the actions of prohibition-oriented states and some parts of the UN drug control apparatus, particularly the increasingly belligerent INCB. The closing years of the decade, however, also demonstrated that not all states were able to pursue revised national interest through a process of soft affection. For its own very specific set of reasons, Bolivia became the first party to move for an amendment of any of the treaties and initiate a formal change of the regime. This triggered a hostile response from a range of countries. Indeed, beyond the very public rebukes from the board, concerted opposition in 2010 and 2011 from a US-led group of friends of the conventions, including some of those from the ICE26, blocked attempts to amend the single convention. Now, this left Bolivia with no other option than to withdraw from the treaty and move to re-accede with a reservation on coca, an unprecedented process that actually remains ongoing today. It also revealed that having achieved their aims in relation to harm reduction, many states from the ICE26 had no interest in further rocking the boat for an issue with no obvious benefit to them, a decision no doubt influenced to some extent by Washington's stance on the issue. That said, more recent events in Latin America suggest that Bolivia may not be alone in moving beyond the practice of soft affection that did much to characterise the UNGAS decade. Escalating levels of drug-related violence within the region has resulted in a reassessment of current policies at the highest level. This has taken place in a unilateral and a coordinated fashion. The most notable example of the former was in June this year, when the president of Uruguay announced his intention to establish a government monopoly to control cannabis for recreational use. Now, that's a policy option that is completely impermissible within the accepted limits of the current treaty framework. at a multilateral level, following the statements from presidents, the presidents of Colombia, Mexico and Guatemala for a rethink on global drug policy, the Organization of American States agreed within its Inter-American Commission on Drug Abuse, a body called CCAD, to undertake a study to look at the effectiveness of current policies and explore, among other things, as the slide shows, options and scenarios for the development of new approaches to drug policy. Now, significantly, the CCAD study will incorporate a spectrum of options ranging from, I think, what we can call super prohibition, all the way across to regulated markets. Due next year, it remains to be seen if the US can use its influence within the OAS, the Organization of American States, to quash what officials in Washington deem to be any uncomfortable recommendations within the resulting report. And it should be remembered, I think, that as with their opposition to Bolivia's coca-related travails, it is likely that officials in a range of drug control bureaucracies have one eye on the planned marijuana ballot initiatives in several US states. Perhaps as a reaction to possible US influence on CCAD's findings, on October the 1st, so only a few days ago, the presidents of Mexico, Colombia and Guatemala followed up on their speeches at the UN General Assembly session in September by issuing a joint declaration concerning a revision of global drug policy. Among other things, Presidents Calderon, Santos and Molina declared that the United Nations should exercise its leadership, as is its mandate, in this effort and conduct deep reflection to analyse all available options, including regulatory or market measures, in order to establish a new paradigm that prevents the flow of resources to organised crime organisations. Now, while it's unlikely that such calls or the convening of an associated conference will come to anything, in the near future at least, I think, the declaration is significant for a number of reasons. First, it's another indication of some states' appreciation that there is only so much flexibility within the current treaty framework, and that national interests would be better served by working towards changes of the regime. Second, the coordinated efforts by the three presidents looks very much like the beginnings of a like-minded group of nations. The history and current functioning of the UN system, including in the realm of drug control, shows the value of a like-minded group approach to not only forming regimes, but also in initiating various forms of change. Indeed, it's possible to argue that Bolivia's attempts to amend the single convention may have had more traction had La Paz developed a like-minded coalition around the coca issue. That said, as both the Bolivian case in particular and events within the CND during the UNGAS decade more generally demonstrate, finding shared areas of concern around which states' national interests may coalesce is difficult. While there is a growing appreciation of deficiencies within the current system, there remains little widespread agreement on how to address them beyond engaging in soft defecting behaviour, a process that, by avoiding a direct challenge to the regime, actually does much to sustain the regime in its present form. Within such an uncertain and paradoxical policy environment, one thing remains clear. Despite experiencing an ongoing process of transformation, the regime in its current form, and this is a point that brings me back to my rather laboured title, will simply not wither away. Those prohibition-oriented states favouring the status quo will, in cooperation with the INCB, certainly go to great lengths to stifle any treaty revision. That's not to say, however, that concerted efforts cannot bring about a change of the regime. And as we enter what I think should be regarded as a new phase in the life cycle of the global drug prohibition regime, it's worthwhile recalling the words of Daniel Duprat of the Canadian Parliament Law and Government Division. In 1998, remember the year of the UNGAS, Duprat observed of drug control, laws evolve to reflect changes in the society that adopts them. International standards will evolve as the international community evolves, but time and effort must go into that process. Thank you.